Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast, a monthly podcast featuring events from Penn Faulkner's reading series and occasional clips from our archives. I'm Lily Meyer, Public Programs Coordinator of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and in episode 33, we bring you highlights from the 2014 Summer Supper and Book Club, an offshoot of Penn Faulkner's Writers in Schools program, which provides D.C. area high school kids with complimentary copies of contemporary literature and the perk of meeting the writers behind the work. The episode begins with a reading by Susan Richards Shreve, prolific writer, professor of creative writing at George Mason University, and co-chair of Penn Faulkner's board of directors. Susan has published 14 novels, and here she reads from her dark comedy, Plum and Jaggers.
I'm going to read the beginning of chapter 6. The beginning of the book starts on a rather low or high note when there is an explosion on a train on the way to Rome with a family of four. The parents are in the lunch car, and that particular car is blown up, leaving four children as orphans raised in Washington, D.C., a very familiar Washington, D.C. to most of you here. By their grandparents in the 70s, but this is 1985. Just after 7 p.m. on July 18th, the month following Sam's, who's the oldest child, graduation from Shady Hill Friends School, a bomb exploded on the Red Line train at the Cleveland Park Metro Station. Five people were injured. One was a three-year-old boy. Sam heard about it on the radio. He and Charlotte were in the office behind their house when the all-music station interrupted with news of the bomb and a warning not to take the Red Line. "We're going," Sam said. Charlotte looked up from a play she was reading. "Something could happen to us," she said. "I don't think so," Sam said. They were going to go, of course. Charlotte knew that. They always did what Sam had in mind they should do. But this hot summer evening, coming on dusk, heavy with the smell of roses and honeysuckle slipping through the open garage window, she didn't want to see the scene of a bombing. "On your feet," Sam said, turning off the fan. Charlotte put a marker in the glass menagerie and closed the collected plays of Tennessee Williams. In the last year, she had become an actress, gifted, according to her drama teacher at Woodrow Wilson High School. Inspired, described her roles as Emily in Our Town and Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. Sam had taught her. Evenings after dinner, when Noli thought they were in the office doing their homework, Noli is their grandmother, they played Plum and Jaggers. Charlotte had the lead. Acting had come upon her unexpectedly, like a sign on the road to Damascus, a religious transformation. She discovered that she could leave the quiet, responsible young woman called Charlotte McWilliams in her bedroom, reading Anna Karenina, and become somebody else whose life she never had to lead. Somebody new. She was giddy with the pleasure of it. Her grades fell. Her dreamy afternoons lying on her stomach with a book were over. Her longing for a love affair slipped away. "We'll have a company," Charlotte Sam had said to her one early spring afternoon in his senior year. "The four of us on the road, Plum and Jaggers." Family comedy troupe. Sam told his grandparents they were going to the 8 o'clock show at the Uptown Theater. "I hate to lie to them," Charlotte said, settling into the front seat of their grandfather's old yellow Mercury, which Sam drove, Julia and Oliver in the back seat. "They don't want to know the truth," Sam said. "Anyway, we might go to the movies," Oliver said. "I don't want to go to the movies," Julia said solemnly. "I want to see the explosion." "That's what we're doing," Sam said. At 12, Julia was rail-thin with tiny breasts, a small bottom the size of a muskmelon, and long, wavy black hair with a purple stripe. She had put a full-length mirror on the door in her office of the house on Morrison Street so she could gauge her sullen expressions. After Sam went to live at the Episcopal Home for Juvenile Delinquents, she did not return to school. She had read a piece in the Washington Post about a girl in second grade who was homeschooled and had persuaded Noli to take on the job of teaching her. She was happy working with Noli, spending her afternoons with Oliver and Charlotte and Sam, keeping up with the culture of her peers by poring over teenage magazines at People's Drugstore, memorizing the vocabulary, the look, the shifting hip, the expression of endless boredom. The magazines gave her a sense of how to speak and act without actually experiencing the growing cynicism of adolescence. She was wise-seeming, but innocent, with a fetching honesty that burst forth with whatever was on her mind. But recently, during the slow afternoon, she had become restless, longing for friends, for younger conversation, and she began to think of going to Alice Beale Junior High for seventh grade, just to try it out. In preparation, she had dyed her hair and bought dangly silver earrings at the 5 and 10 and changed her wardrobe from jeans to skimpy silky dresses through which her tiny, perfectly formed nipples were clearly visible. During the summer, Julia didn't wear shoes. On the day of the explosion in the Cleveland Park Metro, she had painted her toenails black with small white flowers and drawn a vermilion snake with purple dots slithering up her leg. She sat in the back seat examining the snake, which was peeling. "I suppose no one died in the explosion, right, Sam?" she asked. "Right, Julia," Sam said. "No one died." "Bummer," she said. Thank you.
Next, we have Elliot Holt, who is a DC native, short story writer, and author of You Are One of Them, published in 2013. Here, Elliot reads from the beginning of her novel.
I'll read a section I don't usually read aloud, but why not? This is the beginning of chapter 2. I met Jennifer Jones in 1980. It was the summer of the Moscow Olympics, and I was devastated that the American athletes were denied the chance to compete because of the boycott. I was a gymnast then, and although I was not good enough to be an Olympic hopeful, I was too tall and too scared of turning somersaults on the balance beam. There was an older girl named Amanda at my gymnastics club who had made the U.S. team. She was 16. By the time the L.A. Games rolled around, she'd be 20 and past her prime. "Why," I remember asking my mother, "did the Soviet athletes have CCCP on the backs of their uniforms instead of USSR?" She explained that the Russians had a different alphabet, that in Cyrillic what looked to us like a C sounded like an S, and what looked like a P sounded like an R. And the Russian name for the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was abbreviated as SSSR. This was a mind-blowing concept for an eight-year-old. It had never before occurred to me that there could be other alphabets, that somewhere out in the world people were arranging entirely different shapes into words. Like most American children of my generation, I had learned the alphabet watching Sesame Street. When episodes were brought to us by the letter S, I always smiled because S was my letter. And now my mother was telling me that in the Russian alphabet, the S looked like a C. She might as well have told me that I didn't exist. "It was like money," she said. "Different countries have different currencies and you have to exchange them. Different coins and different letters sometimes." I knew about foreign currency. My father had given me a few English pounds. The Olympic boycott was one of many signs that 1980 was a turning point in the Cold War. Tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union were escalating. Whenever my mother said this, I thought of escalators. For years, escalators had scared me, a phobia caused by the steep ones of the DC Metro, which plummets straight into darkness. Riding down into the stations induced such panic in me that for several years we didn't ride the metro at all. "What are you so afraid of?" my father asked me when I was 6, as if I could rationally analyze my fear. He wasn't afraid of anything, my father, or didn't seem to be. And until my phobia of escalators developed, he thought I was like him. "You're turning into your mother's child," he said to me.
We now have a reading from Danielle Evans, author of the short story collection Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self, from which she reads here.
Hello, everybody. So I'm glad you guys could make it tonight. This is actually my last, or at least a long while, DC reading, because I'm moving to Wisconsin on Thursday. So I've been doing a bunch of these, and I'm like, oh, this is the last one. So if I get a little bit sentimental, you'll have to excuse me. So I'm just going to read to you for a couple minutes, and I don't know if you guys have already had a chance to talk about the book some, or if you have questions, then I'll just open it up to you, and we'll take it from there. I'm going to read just the first couple pages of the story, Wherever You Go, There You Are. I think my pages are different than the paperback pages, but it's the second to last story in the book. take Chrissy for a little bit, Aunt Edie says, because apparently I pass for a role model these days. It's Thursday night, and they're standing on the doorstep unannounced. Aunt Edie doesn't bother coming in. She looks exhausted, her eyes puffy from crying, her usually impeccably braided white hair hanging loose and disheveled. Her last living sibling, Chrissy's grandfather, has been in the hospital all summer, and odds are he isn't coming out again. I tell Aunt Edie that I'm going out of town tomorrow, which is true. There's a half-packed suitcase on my bed to prove it. She tells me I can take Chrissy with me, which more or less settles it. Chrissy breezes past me. Her footsteps on the creaking wood floor of my father's house swallow her hello. I have a long list of reasons why Chrissy shouldn't come on this trip, but few of them I'll admit to myself, let alone to my great aunt. In any case, she isn't leaving much room for argument. I'm tired, says Aunt Edie. She needs someone to look out for her, and I've got other things on my mind right now. She reaches into her purse and stretches out her hand to give me Chrissy's cell phone, which Chrissy is apparently banned from using. Her father's not leaving Bobby's bedside, Aunt Edie goes on, and Tia can't take her because she's too busy with nursing school, so that leaves you. I stop myself from asking who it is Tia is supposed to be nursing. Tia is Aunt Edie's granddaughter, my cousin, Chrissy's too, but she is not a nurse or a nursing student. She may possibly own a nursing uniform, but if she does, it has breakaway snaps, and she's generally wearing a G-string under it. I don't know where Aunt Edie got nursed from, but no one's allowed to say Tia's a stripper. Tia's job bothers Aunt Edie for reasons involving hellfire and eternal damnation. It bothers me because even though Tia's 25 like I am, she looks 13. I love her, don't get me wrong, but she's got chicken legs, nothing in the way of hips or boobs, and a big head with wide almond eyes and a long blonde weave. And while I can imagine the many reasons my boy men might pay good money to see a real live woman, there's something unsettling about so many of them paying to see a real live Bratz doll. In fairness, there isn't much else to do in Waterton, Delaware. It's close to everything else in Delaware without actually being part of any of it. About an hour from the noisy hedonism of Rehoboth Beach and Ocean City's boardwalks, about an hour from the suburban sprawl subdivisions that might as well be North Maryland or South Jersey. It's not quite the Delaware that's mostly pig and tobacco farms, though there are farms in Waterton, and a fresh fruit and vegetable stand every mile or so, and the world's largest grapple factory. When you approach the city limits from the highway, there's a painted wooden sign that says, "Welcome to Waterton. Wherever you go, there you are." It doesn't tell you that where you are is a city that gets 70% of its annual revenue from ticketing speeding tourists who got lost on their way to the beach. It's mostly a town that still exists because no one's gotten around to telling it that it can't anymore. The highlight of most people's weekends is losing money down at the Seahorse Casino, which is 40 minutes away and not even a fun casino. It's just a big room full of slot machines and fluorescent light, and the only drinks they serve are shitty beer and something called Delaware Punch, which tastes less like punch and more like the Seahorse Casino is determined to single-handedly use up the nation's entire supply of banana schnapps. Considering the options, it makes sense that Tia does good business here. I live here because right now I have no place else to be. The house I'm staying in is my father's and was my grandfather's before that. It was either come here and be alone for a while or move in with my mother, which would have felt like an admission of failure on both of our parts. The house is on the back corner of a parcel of land that was once large enough that it meant something for black people to own it, but it's been divided and subdivided through the years, split between children and wills, sold off piecemeal to developers, whittled down so that between the 15 of us, everyone in my generation probably owns about a square inch of it. My father moved into the house 20 years ago, after my parents' divorce, looking for a place to get his head together. Or at least my father's furniture moved into the house. My father himself got into the antiques market and seemed perpetually on a plane to some faraway place in pursuit of a stamp, a coin, a rare baseball card, anything of more than obvious value. Now that I'm here again, I can hardly blame him for leaving so often. I'm learning the hard way that it's not a good place to get over anything. In every room of the house, fighting with my father's coin chest and signed sports posters and ceramic knickknacks, there's a reminder of what people are supposed to mean to each other. The set of initials carved into the handmade frame of the front door. A sepia-toned photograph of my grandparents who died within weeks of each other, months after their 45th anniversary. The lavender corsage my grandmother wore at her wedding. My Uncle Bobby found it pressed into my grandfather's Bible decades later and had it framed on the wall of the master bedroom. The wooden archway leading to the dining room, the one that had been knocked down and rebuilt by my father at Uncle Bobby's request the year a foot amputation confined his wife to a wheelchair too big to fit through the original doorway. The wedding quilt on the living room wall, the one thing besides their life savings that my grandparents had salvaged from the house they fled in Georgia, hours before a mob tortured it in a trumped-up theft charge. As a child, I'd taken comfort in the house's memorabilia. I imagine this was the sort of unconditional love that all adults had eventually. But now, fresh off the end of my last relationship, the house feels like a museum of lack. Here is the sort of love you never saw up close. Here are souvenirs from all the places your father was when he was not with you. Here is something whole that one day you will own a fraction of.
The next reader is David Ebenbach, who is a poet, essayist, and fiction writer. David has published 4 books in 3 genres, and he reads a new short story here.
I read a a story for you that's not in the book so that you can get something new. It's called If She Doesn't Answer, and it's a pretty new story. So it seemed like, I mean, I have it on a Kindle, you know, it's just like kind of right hot off the press. Okay, so it's called If She Doesn't Answer. If I don't answer, it hasn't happened, she thinks, sitting up in bed in the very dark. The phone by the bedside is ringing. It's an old phone, the kind people used to mount to kitchen walls when she was a kid. She remembers the spiral cord tethering her to the wall back then, talking to her crazy grandmother, who wouldn't leave the house and who feared everyone and had to talk about it. And she's been tethered to this phone, this bedside phone, during calls with her own mother. But this ringing isn't that. It's not another call of whispered paranoias, even though those too used to come at around this hour. It's 3:17 in the morning. She just knows what it is, how much worse it is, and she's right. The phone rings, and despite the fact that she has her voicemail set to pick up after four rings, this phone rings past the fourth, the fifth, the sixth. It rings on and on. She won't pick it up. She's not ready to allow it. A few minutes pass so that she almost becomes used to the sound, the unanswerable sound coming from the bedside phone. Then, in a corner of the room on the little low table where it's plugged in, her cell starts to ring. The two phones ring in an overlapping way, though not at the same intervals. By her bedside, this even alternation between chirruping and pause, and from the little table across the room, this awful drumming music that barely breathes between its repetitions. The cell phone, too, is supposed to go to voicemail after a short time, but it continues past that. The incoming news is stronger than any of the limitations she's set. You don't control that technology, her mother had once warned her. She gets out of bed. Even in the very dark, she can see well enough to move out of the room and stand in the hall at the top of the stairs, where there's a little light coming in from the downstairs living room windows. The ringing continues behind her. They are like the early seizing feelings of grief. She realizes that she's cold in a t-shirt and sweat shorts, no blanket, nothing, and the house, even in the early summer, retreating into a bone cold each night. The wood floors feel like chilled tile. She can't go back into the bedroom for her bathrobe because her mother is dead there, dead in the bedroom, in the phones. She will have to stay out here, be cold out here. Or further from the ringing, she turns toward her office where she could sit in the sallow glow of the computer, which is the rest of the world and not this. She steps along the cold wood, echoing with the sound of ringing, to the door of the office, and she puts her hand on the cool wooden jamb, holds the jamb in her hand. The computer's open on the desk. It's on, though the screen is sleeping. The computer stays there through the night, still talking to the outside. It occurs to her what that means, how this computer is an open window, wide open to anything. And just then, the computer pings. She can hear it distinct from the phones. The sound means that the outside has talked back, has left a message for her. She knows what it is. As she backs away, the computer pings again, though it can't do that. She moves quickly down the hall and turns down the stairs, stairs that are strangely quiet under her feet during all this clamor, as though she's not capable of making noise herself, as though she can only receive it or defend herself against it, as though all she has is this sound of grief trying to get in, this knocking. There is, in fact, a knock on her door. It happens when she reaches the bottom of the stairs, here in the middle of the night, a knocking. Her front door is wooden, with a window on the top half, a window obscured by a curtain, so that even with the porch light on, she leaves it on in the hope it will ward things off. A hope that seems ridiculous to her now, because a break-in, a burglary, those things are so small now, so beneath consideration. Even with the porch light on, she can only see the outline of the person at the door. It's the shape of her grandfather, stooped even before he was old. It's the shape of her father, his hand squeezing his face to hold it still. It's the shape of her sister, of her aunt, both of them together holding hands for strength. There in the weak yellow light, it's the silhouette of her mother, older than she should be, and the shape of what she's done to herself. The daughter reaches back to grip the banister so that she won't fall. She remembers the time her mother put her in a closet of her home, frantic, saying, "You'll be safe here. Don't worry about me. You'll be safe here." And she stayed there for longer than seemed possible, the heat of the summer day steadily building in there. And finally she came out, the light in her empty stomach telling her that the morning had gone over to afternoon. And she looked around until she found her mother in the closet of her parents' bedroom, or found the closed door and just knew she was in there. And she sat against the door and didn't say anything until something shifted and it was safe enough for her mother to come out. They had a late lunch and too much ice cream. Upstairs, the phones continue to ring. The computer repeats its message, and the shadow knocks on the door again. There is a pause, and then the knocking becomes regular, a beat, a drip from a broken faucet. She sits on the cold bottom step of her stairs and holds her face in her hands, covers her face with her hands. She only looks up when she hears the sound of the mail slot low in the door. In front of her now, there is a photograph on the floor, a square. It's a picture of her face, not as it was when she was a child and she didn't yet realize how serious things were, not as an older child when she was scared, not as an adult who has always been grim about what she knows. It's a photo of the future, of how she will look from the moment that she answers, when she picks up the phone, when she reads the message, when she opens the door. Her head ringing, she kneels on the ground in the space between the stairs and the front door where the knocking continues, and she picks up the photograph. It's a picture of the present, of starting right now.
And last but not least, we have Derek Weston Brown, a DC resident and poet, reading two short poems for us.
Legacy. My father's vocabulary is extensive, but he still can't find the words for I love you, nor the synonyms, acronyms, or abbreviations. I guess this is why I am a poet. I inherited the words lost to his dictionary. I am the new volume, updated, New Testament. I will read the one train. I'll read Miss Train. That's page 28. I smelled you at the metro stop, tasted you on the yellow, glimpsed you on the green, caught you on the orange, loved you on the red, lost you on the blue. Now I need a transfer, or at least exit fare, because no one deserves to take such a ride and end up being taken for every dime. Baby, you a last minute change of plans. An unexpected phone call at the God hour that leaves me feeling mortal.
The Pen Faulkner podcast series is made possible by the generous support of Amazon.com and is co-sponsored by the Folger Shakespeare Library. Pen Faulkner wishes to thank our reading series underwriters, Hill's Kitchen, a kitchen specialty shop here in D.C.'s Eastern Market, Sonoma Restaurant, serving locally sourced cuisine and an amazing selection of wines, just a stone's throw from the Library of Congress on Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, Aegean Arts Circle, a writing workshop and retreat that takes place each summer in Andros, Greece, and New York University's MFA program in creative writing, and their new low residency MFA in Paris, France. We also want to thank Benedict Koopstas for composing and performing the music used in this episode. It comes from his album, Boo Forever, which you can find at fieldguides.bandcamp.com/album/booforever. For more information on how you or your business can help underwrite Pen Faulkner's reading series or awards programming, give us a call at 202-898-9063 or drop us a line at info@penfaulkner.org. Of course, we couldn't do any of the work we do without the support of individuals, foundations, businesses, and government agencies. Learn more about how to give at penfaulkner.org/support.